Henry Ward Beecher was a pioneer of modern evangelical Christianity, a major figure in the anti-slavery movement, an outspoken opponent of anti-Semitism, an early feminist, and an advocate for American Indians. He was the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, and Walt Whitman, Henry David Thoreau, and Mark Twain were some of his friends. His sermons were Brooklyn's biggest tourist attraction. But today, this superstar is mostly forgotten. Debbie Applegate has written a new biography of Pastor Beecher and of the sex scandal that tarnished his reputation, called The Most Famous Man in America. It's published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased to welcome Ms. Applegate to my show today. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
Wouldn't he be called a liberal today?
He had some very moderate instincts, but indeed he was liberal in the sense that he himself defined as generous, tolerant, accepting, and interested in everything.
And yet his father, Lyman Beecher, is generally regarded as the last of the great Puritan ministers. Would that mean that they had very different views of how religion should work in the world?
Lyman was a reformer in the sense that he wanted law and order, and Henry was a reformer in the sense that he wanted justice, he wanted change. And even though they were both very passionate, both very religious, that was probably the biggest difference between them.
Well, was Henry's interpretation of the scriptures an act of rebellion?
It was both an act of rebellion and an act of homage, I would say. Lyman Beecher was really an Old Testament kind of guy, a fire and brimstone, real Puritan legacy kind of guy, whereas Beecher was scarred by that as a child. He did not see any way to salvation if he had to wait for God to bring him grace. So he really was one of the very first people to make popular the idea of a more New Testament-based, Jesus-oriented kind of Christianity, where Jesus was your best friend, was there to heal you rather than to be a scapegoat and an atoner for your sins.
And that is kind of the basis of modern evangelical Christianity.
Right.
Even if that, to some degree, has changed, there are a lot of evangelicals who probably would recognize themselves in Henry Ward Beecher.
Oh, I think most evangelicals believe that the relationship, the personal heart relationship between you and Jesus is the fundamental part of the Christian relationship. That really was not what Lyman Beecher and his generation believed. It was God, and it was obedience, and it was worship, not friendship, not consolation.
Henry Ward Beecher was, as your title suggests, the most famous man in America during his lifetime. How is he remembered in most history textbooks today?
Well, a little tiny bit of a clerical buffoon in some ways. Partly that's because he was famous for stunts. He was a big anti-slavery activist, so he would do things, very dramatic things. He would auction off slaves from his pulpit in Brooklyn Heights to free them. You know, people would, he would, you know, pretend to be an auctioneer and bring the slave up, and people would throw money and jewelry and watches into the collection basket, which, as you can imagine, caused a big fuss. In the press, he sent rifles to the Free State settlers out in Kansas, which became nicknamed Beecher's Bibles, which, of course, also, you know, the idea of Christian self-defense, a brand new idea. Those are the good things he's remembered for, but they do not make him seem very serious.
But they made him into a tourist attraction.
Oh, and not just that. He was, at a time when religion was very serious, very solemn, he did things like make jokes from the pulpit. He brought flowers. He was one of the first to bring flowers and congregational singing. Well, the Methodists sang that way, but not the Congregationalists, not the Presbyterians. And it shocked people at first, but it really drew them. And soon people began just flocking. The church still stands in Plymouth. Plymouth Church still stands in Brooklyn Heights, and it is huge. It can hold 2,000 people seated, 3,000 people with standing room only, and he filled it every Sunday.
So this was a mega church before we talked about mega churches.
Exactly right.
This is an amazing family, isn't it? Is this because of Lyman Beecher's guidance?
Lyman Beecher really was devoted to his children, even though he scarred them a little bit with some of his theological preaching.
And he had 12 kids?
12 kids, 13, one who died, and almost every one of them just remarkable. And that's largely because he pushed them to be remarkable. He pushed all seven of his sons into the ministry. Three of his daughters became really quite famous, two of them the most famous women in America at the time. And really, it was driven not just by his love, but his sense that they needed to be serving God.
Well, driven, on the other hand, to committed suicide.
Yes, and you know, that's a hard thing to talk about in that obviously they had their own psychological issues that were not helped by the dark view of life that he offered.
What about his wife? Did she play any role in any of this?
Which one, Eunice or Lyman?
Lyman's.
Lyman's wife, a very important role in that she was really also a very remarkable woman, brilliant, educated, very scientifically minded, but she also died when Henry was three. And that death really shaped his life in that he spent the rest of his life looking for the comfort of women.
Mm-hmm. He was not much was expected of him initially.
Well, he was, yes, it was a brilliant family filled with all kinds of ambitious children, and he was boisterous, he was blithe, he wanted nothing more than to just be happy on earth, and his father was more than willing to trade his happiness on earth for happiness in heaven.
My guess is Debbie Applegate. She's written The Most Famous Man in America, the biography of Henry Ward Beecher, which is published by Doubleday. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. And Henry Ward Beecher called his approach the gospel of love. How would you describe that? How would you define it?
He really believed that what God wanted was not fealty, was not obedience, but what God wanted was for people on earth to be happy and to feel his love.
And how did he come to this? Was this something that was in the air? Were other people also talking this
there
way?
There certainly were, and I'm sure there are some religious historians who would say, oh, don't give Beecher too much credit, but really what he did was take some of those ideas that were in the air and some of those ideas which are really deeply embedded in the New Testament and bring them to the forefront in a way that was not happening before and in a way that allowed people to feel that love in part because he felt it so greatly. He just emanated love from the pulpit in his writings. And there are thousands of fan letters, many of which are saved in the Yale archives, that you can see people really, they just thought he loved them personally. And you can also see how that then led to some problems later
on. He was charismatic, and charismatic figures often have a broad appeal to people and sometimes have an appeal to broads.
I hadn't heard that one before.
I just made it up, but I'll try to remember it. So, but did his views change over the years?
He certainly became more bold. Part of his talent was he was not a radical. He was not the boldest person around, but he had a really good instinct for what would be just new enough for people to be excited about, for people to follow, to be provocative, but not so far that people would be frightened or turn away. And so as he got more successful, he did become more bold.
What about the abolitionism? After all, his sister wrote probably the most famous abolitionist novel. He wrote novels as well.
He wrote a novel, and it's not the greatest novel.
Would it have been anything like Harriet Beecher Stowe's writing?
Well,
she's not the greatest writer that ever lived either.
She is not to everyone's taste nowadays, but boy, if you actually pick up Uncle Tom's Cabin, it really pulls you through all 600 pages. It can't say quite the same for his.
Did they come to abolitionism separately, or is this something that pretty much the whole family agreed on?
Lyman Beecher was very conservative about these things. He did not want the kingdom of God to be compromised by the fight over slavery because it was so contentious, so ugly, and so violent. And in fact, the real problem is the Bible countenances slavery to a large extent. And so it was very difficult to make the case as a religious person, for why slavery should end.
And New York was a city that perhaps was a little more tolerant of slavery because of commerce, it's been said.
More than tolerant. They were willing to secede, many New Yorkers.
So how did he become so popular? How did he wind up in Brooklyn, for example? Why not a Manhattan church?
He was a Yankee, and Brooklyn Heights back then, and when he arrived here in 1847, was a beautiful bucolic village, and, right across the river, and fantastic views, green, and goats and pigs and, cows everywhere, and he really grew with the city. And that was part of it, is he loved Manhattan. The glitter of Manhattan was everything to him, but he really enjoyed what, like a lot of people do now, the quiet and family-like life of Brooklyn.
How did word spread about his speeches?
Well,
or his sermons?
Were
they printed?
They were printed. At first, it was literally just that, there was not a lot of respectable entertainment for people, for families, for women, for children. You could go to the pool halls or you could go to the dance halls in Manhattan. Brooklyn, of course, did not have any.
It's a borough of churches.
That's right. This was really the beginning of the entertainment industry, people going to lectures, people going to sermons, and he really was unlike any other preacher. He was and became, over time, through that sort of respectable path, perhaps the leading entertainer in the country.
How did other religious figures react to this?
With as you can imagine, at first many people were very suspicious, very disapproving. But he was, and this is the thing that kept me with this project for nearly 20 years. Despite his foibles, despite his zigzag, as he liked to describe it, and sometimes things that were really quite unsavory, like the sexual peccadilloes.
Which we will get to.
Nonetheless, he was so deeply good-hearted and so deeply loving with everyone he knew that he ended up really overcoming those prejudices.
Abraham Lincoln was an admirer.
Abraham Lincoln, his partner, William Herndon, and his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, were huge fans of Beecher. And when Lincoln came to New York to give what became the famous Cooper Union speech, which won him the presidency, it was originally supposed to be at Plymouth Church. But as we all know, the weather got bad, and in bad weather, very hard to get Manhattanites to go to Brooklyn. And so they switched it to New York, into Manhattan. But Lincoln came twice to see Beecher and became a very big fan and felt like he was one of, as Lincoln said, one of the most productive minds in human history.
Which also made him, as you say, one of the most hated men in the Confederacy.
Most certainly.
But he gave the first sermon in the South after it was defeated. How was that treated?
It was the vanquished Fort Sumter, so there were really no Southerners except ex-slaves and Union soldiers and tourists. They took it by beating the heck out of Charleston. Lincoln felt like this was a man precisely because he was such a man of love that he had the best chance of beginning to unite South and North.
He became friends with some of the most famous people of his time, Emerson, Thoreau, Twain, Whitman. Well, Whitman just lived down the road. Right. But did they only see him as a positive figure? I mean, he was doing religion as entertainment. It's a bit of a showbizzy side to that, and a lot of artists would disdain that sort of approach.
Well, Emerson, he became quite close to, and Emerson was actually probably his biggest rival on the respectable lecture circuit, the entertainment circuit. So we forget sometimes that just because he is high academic now, he was actually quite popular then. In fact, most of them really admired them. Whitman was a huge admirer of Beecher. Thoreau was a little crabby. Thoreau called him a pagan and thought his self-confidence about knowing so much about God was a little overbearing. But in fact, what they loved was Beecher was so bold and so himself, so candid. And in fact, Emerson called him really one of the best example of a transcendentalist that he knew in that sense.
Debbie Applegate has written for publications ranging from the Journal of American History to the New York Times. She's taught at Yale and Wesleyan. And now she's written a biography of Henry Ward Beecher called The Most Famous Man in America, published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Debbie Applegate. Her book, The Most Famous Man in America, the biography of Henry Ward Beecher, is published by Doubleday. So let's talk about the sexual side of the story. It's alleged that Beecher had many affairs. Is that something that happened throughout his life?
Well, you know, we were talking about his mother earlier. He was raised by a very strong interesting, educated sisters and lived, in fact, by a girls' school when he was a child, and really suffered from not having a mother that he could really love. And that really set him up. And he was, I believe the phrase is girl crazy from the time that he was very little. And he did have a pattern of emotional intimacies and flirtations with women who were not his wife. That is indisputable, whatever else one might say.
And I'm sure you were able to document a few of those affairs, but some of them are still alleged to this day.
Well, there are three main affairs documented in there. One of them is entirely new that I discovered only through serendipity of digging through the people's personal archives. And that one, I believe, may have resulted in an illegitimate child. And if you look in the picture, if you look at the pictures, they really are the spitting image of each other. But of course, you know, this is very difficult stuff to talk about. There are still some Beecher descendants who will not even, you know, countenance this idea. And there are many scholars who believe, you know, you can't know what happened in the bedroom.
Did people who knew him know about these affairs?
It was very common. He was so flirtatious. He was, as he got older, he became, you know, not as careful. It was a very commonly said thing that Beecher preaches to six or seven of his mistresses every Sunday. Most people didn't believe it, but there was enough there that rumors began to build.
Well, affairs, sexual affairs, break a commandment.
Yes.
What did he say about adultery in his sermons?
One of the things that made him so popular is he was not a black and white kind of guy. He was not saint versus sinner. He really believed that human motives are mixed, that we try to be our best self, but that we often fail, and that that is the nature of Christianity. That is why Christ came to earth, is to save us from our mixed motives and our worst parts of ourselves.
So he kept on sinning and then forgiving himself.
Well, that is, yes, I think that's true. But I would also say that I think his quest to conquer that sin and the way it provoked his thoughts and his feelings about religion really pushed him to the greatest heights of his gospel of love. Actually, I don't think it would have been possible without him being so cognizant of his own weaknesses.
In 1870, Elizabeth Tilton enters the picture. Can you tell us about that?
Theodore Tilton was Beecher's very close friend. He was his assistant at the New York Independent, where Beecher wrote. He was a very radical anti-slavery guy, radical Republican. And as Beecher became a little more conservative after the war, they began to part ways. And one gets the sense from looking at the record that Beecher began to visit Elizabeth Tilton, Theodore's wife, in part because he was sort of wreaking a little vengeance upon Theodore, who kept attacking him in the press. Elizabeth was one of his parishioners, incredibly pious, incredibly devoted to Beecher, and she genuinely seemed not to believe that anything they were doing was wrong.
Well, is it sure that they actually had an affair? It still seems rather unclear.
Well, there was a huge trial, a trial that really is similar only maybe to the O.J. Simpson trial, and really had as many reporters and as much coverage. In fact, more headlines, more newspaper headlines than even the Civil War came out of the civil trial in Brooklyn. The problem was that both Beecher and Elizabeth Tilton contradicted themselves a great deal. They made what sounded like confessions or were indeed confessions and then retracted them and then made them again. And Beecher wanted to commit suicide, but then said it was, oh, it wasn't that it was because he felt guilty. It was because he just was sorry that all this fuss had come up. In the end, the jury in the civil trial was hung. It was 9 in favor of Beecher and 3 against Beecher. And that sort of is the way he remained and remains, I think, to this day.
And Elizabeth Tilton kept on changing her story practically to the end of her life.
Yes, to the end of her life. Although her final statement when she had nothing left to lose, when she was a pariah in the community, was that they had indeed had an affair and she had lied about it.
It's interesting that all the people involved, and we'll get to a couple more of them, did rather well in their lives. The two people who didn't do well were the Tiltons.
No.
Theodore Tilton and Elizabeth Tilton both died in rather mean straits.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's something about attacking the most popular man in the country that is a big risk. And, you know, and he lost. I don't think he thought he was going to lose that case.
What was Victoria Woodhull's role in this affair?
Victoria Woodhull really comes in like a wild card in the middle of the plot or in the latter stages of the plot.
Most people think of her as the free love candidate for the presidency.
As she was. And in fact, she had gotten to know Beecher and Tilton because they were, and the Tiltons, because they were all involved in the women's rights movement. And they at first befriended her, but it very quickly became clear that she was, you know, a loose cannon, and they tried to pull away. And then when she ran for president, she was so angry that neither Beecher nor Tilton supported her candidacy that she threatened to make all these rumors public. And then did, which at first people did not believe. But because there had been so much groundwork, so many rumors, so much talk about it, eventually the press was forced to pick it up.
Well, how did the press portray Beecher during the scandal?
At first, they were outraged. It was absolutely impossible that a man who is so candid and so loving and so good for so many years could possibly have done this. But little by little, all these letters came out, all the letters that had been saved, not just before, during what might have been called, what might have been an affair, but also during what was clearly a cover-up. Regardless of what happened before, there was a very clear cover-up.
What about his wife, Eunice Bullard?
Eunice is a sad character, and in fact, I wish I had wanted to put more about her in the book, and for space reasons, she got cut, because it's not easy to be the wife of a famous man, and they were really incompatible deep down. She was the first girl who gave him the time of day, so he married her, and they really were not suited. She was a very sour person, very jealous, and so she just got more and more sidelined over time.
Do you think she was aware of his affairs?
I think she was very jealous. She knew he was very flirtatious. She knew that he had a lot of close female friendships. But I think that she absolutely believed 100% that he was innocent and a victim. And it was her being there in the trial day after day, even when he was not in the courtroom, that made a big difference, I think, for the jury.
You said that some people believe that that Beecher had this affair with Elizabeth Tilton, if he did, out of a kind of revenge. There seems to be a lot of revenge in the story, a lot more than I imagine occurs today, or maybe I'm naive. Henry Bowen plays a major role in all this, and he seems to have had some kind of meanness of spirit and revenge in mind when he went after Beecher.
Well, you know, there were rumors that Beecher had an affair with his wife, and that I can't prove one way or the other.
Is Henry Bowen like the Rupert Murdoch of his day?
He was not quite that successful, but he was a very successful merchant here, a dry goods merchant, and then a publisher here in New York City. And he was known for having a Yankee-type fistedness and a Yorker aggressiveness, which was not very popular. And he was Beecher's first patron, who brought him here to Brooklyn from Indiana. And
one of the founders of the church.
That's right. He was one of the founders of Plymouth Church, and he, you know, he, I think, quite rightly felt betrayed by Beecher's peccadilloes, whether they were his financial sloppiness or his, you know, his unreliability in other ways. I mean, he was not the most reliable man. He was not the most stand-up guy in every way. And Bowen was quite right. However, it is true that it became a vendetta, and it was clearly something, as with Tilton, that they just could not stomach this man getting so much fame, so much adulation, knowing that there was an ugly underside to him.
What about members of the congregation?
Now, Plymouth Church was entirely behind Beecher, almost entirely. After the trial, as you can imagine, he had tremendous legal bills. They voted him an extra $100,000 bonus, and this was in 1875 to pay off his legal bills.
Now, of that course, had to be a couple of million today.
I can't do the math myself, but it is not coincidental, however, that several of his lawyers were actually members of the congregation, so perhaps they had something to do with that.
So his reputation may have been tarnished generally with the national public, but not locally. In the end, he comes out of it okay, doesn't he?
Well, he won his trial, or he at least walked away from the trial. He remained very popular. He was able to rebuild his lecture career. He was no longer able to do much writing. People were not as interested in hearing his thoughts about, you know, good ethics and that sort of thing. But he certainly continued to make money, continued to dominate the headlines. Dignitaries still came to visit. Oscar Wilde came to visit him right not long before his death, just because he was in America. That's who you go see, is Beecher.
Debbie Applegate's biography of Henry Ward Beecher is called The Most Famous Man in America. It's published by Doubleday. So what does Henry Ward Beecher have in common with a modern evangelical preacher like Billy Graham? Is he the right one to compare him with?
It's a really difficult comparison because, for one thing, ministers no longer have the kind of social and cultural cachet that they used to.
But I mean, Pat Robertson became a major figure. He's an evangelical. He ran for president.
The thing about Beecher was he really crossed religious lines, denominational lines. He crossed class lines. He was, in his own way, like more, I shouldn't even say this, but he's almost more like Paris Hilton with some substance than he was like a Billy Graham. However, Billy Graham is a good example in that people will still flock to him by the hundreds of thousands. Really, I would say we may be heading into a new period where the kind of liberal ecumenicalism, the social justice kind of side of Christianity may be resurging, and we may see some of those kinds of leaders. But until now, up in the last 50 years, those leaders have been so conservative that it's very difficult to say the same thing.
So he had an impact on American Christianity for a while, and then the church changed.
No, actually, what I would say is the church became what he wanted it to be. If you go to an evangelical church now, they may talk about hellfire and damnation, but far more will they talk about accepting Jesus into your heart, walking with Jesus, being your best friend. Part of the reason Beecher is forgotten, besides his flaws, is because the things that he did have become so a part of American culture that we don't remember that there was ever a time before this.
You suggested a better comparison than Billy Graham might be John F. Kennedy or Bill Clinton or Martin Luther King Jr.
That's a comparison that comes in part from the sexual peccadilloes, that he was driven, like each of those three figures, a very charismatic figure, driven by his desire for approval and approbation from the public. And those are the people, I think, who are most likely to shade over into lust. If you're driven entirely by principle, it's not as likely.
But there are three people who had real appeal because they sounded like they had big ideas.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. And they could communicate.
And that's what
them.
Drew people to
that's
them.
That's right. And they could communicate them in a way that people could really feel them in their hearts as well as in their minds.
I remember when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke, one woman wrote in one of the major magazines that when she met Bill Clinton, she understood why Monica might have that reaction. And I'm assuming that Henry Ward Beecher had elicited the same kind of response.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. From men and from women. He was one of the few ministers who had as many men come to his congregation as he did women. And even myself, you know, I know as much about him as anyone on earth right now. And I there were many times writing this book where I was just, what a jerk. But you know what? In the end, I really believe what he says, which is that people are not always their best self, but that doesn't make them bad.
You spent 16 years working on this?
I started when I was 18 years old as a sophomore in college as part of I worked in the library and I had to put together an exhibit, and I have worked on it ever since. And this is it. After this, I don't know what I'm going to do.
What kind of a person did you think he was when you started?
I was surprised because I was a big bookworm, 19th century novel type reader, and I had never seen anyone who seemed so modern, so irreverent and funny. And I had grown up in a very evangelical culture out west, and my family was half Mormon and half Irish Catholic, and so to me religion looked nothing like the way Beecher presented it. So at first I was mostly just surprised, and then over time we got much closer.
You said that members of the family are still alive, descendants, and that they resist this kind of research. How do you gain access to the documents?
Well, the thing about the Beechers is so many people in the family, and so many letter writers. So there are literally reams and reams and reams of documents. That's just personal mail and personal papers. There are also just hundreds of thousands of newspaper stories and books and articles, all from the 19th century. So in some ways, the problem was not access. All that has been collected. The real problem was weeding through it and trying to make a story that came alive from it.
And trying to separate the myth from the reality.
And sometimes I leave it to the reader to decide.
What is the Brooklyn Church like today? Does it still draw 1,000 people?
It is a smaller congregation, but it looks very much the same. It is almost exactly the same, the sanctuary and the exterior they've built on. They also have really kept Beecher's commitment to social justice. In the 19th century, it was a stop on the Underground Railroad for people coming, for slaves running through New York, and that legacy really still lives there.
Was Beecher one of the first ministers to mix politics with religious talk?
Really. In fact, his father was an innovator in that his father was a minister when there was still a theocracy in Connecticut. And when the theocracy was killed by the legislature, he had to find another way to influence things. And so he became one of the first what we would call the religious right.
How long did Henry Ward Beecher live?
He died in 1887 and was born in 1813.
So, uh-huh. So the scandal actually came near the end of his life.
Yes. Unfortunately for him. Or maybe fortunately, because if it had happened much earlier, who knows where he would have ended up.
Debbie Applegate's biography of Henry Ward Beecher is called The Most Famous Man in America. It's published by Doubleday, and you said that you're not sure where you're going to go from here.
I spent 20 years of my life with Henry Ward Beecher. I haven't the slightest clue what's next.
Well, I'm sure you came upon some interesting characters in writing this book. Who knows? Oh, by the way, Debbie Applegate will be speaking and signing books tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the Brooklyn Historical Society at Pierpont and Clinton Streets. On tomorrow's show, Ron Suskind examines the effectiveness of the Bush administration's counterterrorism efforts since 9/11. And then an admiral shares his new biography of the naval hero John Paul Jones, a key figure in the Revolutionary War. We'll look back to the heyday of Schraff's restaurants, plus one man's quest to learn more about himself and his family by returning to South Africa decades after he fled from apartheid. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshick. We had help today from Jennifer Hickson, Catherine Brewer, Abe Reisman, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow.